meaning that you had enough civilization in your blood to become a citizen and to be divorced legally from the tribe.
Welcome to Bridging the Bones, your podcast connecting the dots of conflict. I am Sodaling Wang. What does it mean to live like an exile while remaining near the land of your ancestors? Meanwhile, your people are regarded almost as an afterthought by the majority ethnic or racial group in society. Our guest today is Dr. Paul Rozier, author of Indigenous Citizens, Native Americans Fight for Sovereignty, 1776 to 2025. Published by W.W. Norton and Company. He is professor of history at Villanova University. We start at the beginning, during the war between Great Britain's famous 13 colonies and the colony mothership.
You note that even back in the 1780s, before the formal formation of the United States from the British 13 colonies, that people like Thomas Jefferson already had some ideas about nationhood and the role, potential role, I should say, that American Indians might play in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the first treaty signed in 1778 with the Delaware Nation, and that's because the fledgling United States or the colonial the colonists really needed Native American support to defeat the British. And so they reached out, established diplomatic relations. And interestingly, that first treaty speaks about the Delaware Nation as having citizens. And it also promises the eventual inclusion of the Delaware Nation in the new nation of what became the United States. So there was a sense of promise, a sense of potential inclusion, that idea of brotherhood, as Jefferson and Washington used that word, broke down pretty quickly due to the racist violence during the war, really highlighted by the Nat Hooten Massacre, in which colonial militia massacred 93 Native children, women, and men in cold blood after determining where all of their material goods were. And so that was just one example of the violence that would soon polarize Native Americans and white Americans.
It might be useful to note that the Nat Hooten, actually a somewhat counterintuitive spelling, G-N-A-D-E-N-H-U-T-T-E-N.
Which translates as grace.
As grace.
Grace, because it was a religious community. It was a Moravian community. These were Christian Indians.
Who had, I think, settled down to a farming life.
Mm-hmm. Adopted Christianity, farming. They were basically following the blueprint that Washington and Jefferson had laid out.
But they were massacred by what was basically a white militia at the time.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And the justification for this was...
Well, there was ongoing violence between Native people and white colonials, partly in large measure because those white colonists were invading and trespassing on Native territory. And what you do when people invade your territory is you defend it. And so violence begot violence. And at some point, it didn't matter if you were a quote unquote peaceful Christian Indian, as the colonial militia called them. They were simply the Indian. And so this racial binary forms very quickly in the United States in the 1780s and 1790s. And so it became very difficult for anyone seen as an Indian to be accepted in this new country because white Americans continued to want Native land.
I find that interesting. I've heard the argument made that white people, white settlers were justified in taking this land because the natives didn't know how to use it, that they were, quote unquote, unproductive because they didn't farm the way that European descended people expected them to farm, or they didn't know how to, you know, supposedly develop the land that they were living on. A stark illustration would the removal of the Cherokee and the Chickasaw be a good example of that?
Mm-hmm. Well, you're right. One justification was Native people weren't using the land productively. The irony is that the Cherokee and the Choctaw and the Chickasaw had very successfully used the land to produce cotton, in part by using enslaved people. So my argument would be that they were removed not because they failed to use the land properly, but because they had demonstrated very clearly the success that you could have with that particular land. But it became very hard for Native people to transition from what white Americans called the savage Indian to the civilized Indian. But even if they were considered a civilized Indian, if they had adopted Christianity, a constitution, which the Cherokee, Choctaw, Chickasaw did, they would still have that word Indian connected to them. And so that binary that I mentioned between a white and an Indian made it very, very difficult for Native people to prove their worth in this racial climate.
So it sounds like a case of moving goalposts, like that the Indians would meet the white settlers, the new United States government in this case, mm-hmm. would meet the demand / standards most of the way, or maybe even all the way, and then they would still be rebuffed.
Mm-hmm.
Like some other excuse would be invented.
Absolutely.
To displace them. And so you note that the Chickasaw and the Cherokee were forcibly moved, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's another way for it? You could say displaced.
Ethnic cleansing, displaced, forcibly
exiled.
Relocated. Yes.
To an area that was then called Indian Territory on mm-hmm. the other side of the Mississippi River
mm-hmm.
to what is now more or less Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they called the Indian Territory the Great American Desert. They knew very little about it, but they didn't care. It was simply the unoccupied space where close to 90,000 Native people could be sent to, often during difficult conditions. I'm sure everyone knows about the Trail of Tears. That's connected to the Cherokee, but almost every nation had a Trail of Tears, a version of that. Native people in the North, people in the Midwest, Illinois, Indiana. This was an ongoing ethnic cleansing that went on for decades and pushed most of these people into the Midwest and into Oklahoma, where they had to adapt to entirely new ecological conditions, reconstitute their governments that were torn apart by debates about removal. A lot of Native people wanted to stay in the South and try to become citizens of Alabama and Georgia. And those who did were quickly stripped of their land and their rights because the courts didn't recognize the Indian as a citizen. So they had no recourse. They had no justice. And eventually, almost all of them relocated either forcibly or voluntarily.
I'd like to note that there was a exchange during President Andrew Jackson's administration. I think this was post-Civil War. Didn't the Supreme Court at one point admit that the federal government had overstepped its bounds mm-hmm. in terms of how it was treating the Cherokee mm-hmm.
yes.
in the South?
Yes, there were three major Supreme Court decisions that led to the court determining that Native Americans were, quote-unquote, domestic dependent nations that retained some element of their inherent sovereignty. But Jackson, basically, he overrode the Supreme Court and said it didn't matter. This is one of those nullification stories where the court, and this is all based on treaties that the Cherokee had signed. And the treaty said that only the Cherokee can decide to relinquish their territory. So that was what the court ruled, is that the treaties still mattered. But Jackson said, forget about it. The Congress in 1830 passed the Indian Removal Act, which put into motion this dispossession. It's a disjuncture in the federal government's understanding of international law.
Well, I want to know, because I think this will eventually come into play again later, that there seems to be a pattern whereby there, at some level, are at least some officials in the federal government that are trying to, what's the word for it, manage, smooth, negotiate with American Indian nations, if we can call them that, where on the other hand, these few officials tend to get overruled or they tend to get ignored by people, by white settlers at a more local municipal level.
Mm-hmm.
There's many instances of the people,
mm-hmm.
In this case, we're talking about the white people specifically, which was, of course, more narrowly defined back in the 1700s and 1800s. Now, white didn't mean the same thing
mm-hmm.
as it does now. But white people at that time, they often ignored, basically,
mm-hmm.
attempts by some people in federal government to negotiate more peaceful settlements, mm-hmm. more peaceful apportionments, mm-hmm. perhaps, yeah. is the way to put it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're describing settler colonialism, where the pressure put on Native people came from frontier whites, many of whom were immigrants from Scotland, Ireland, Wales, elsewhere, who had experienced their own discrimination. And they applied that lesson to Native people. They bought into this discourse that Indians were savage. So what you have is a federal government that used that as leverage. They were shock troops. The federal government may have said, oh, well, we have treaties, please be nice. But in the end, they were happy that the settlers were pushing the country westward to expand territory, partly because there were continued threats from the British and the Spanish. So the violence that's happening is on a local level, it's on a state level. What you have in the South is states like Georgia and Alabama, Mississippi, Tennessee, all of whom are championing states' rights. And you have in Jackson a president who's willing to let that happen. So there were people who said, we need peace on the frontier. There was no way for the U.S. Army to prosecute these wars. So what you have is a lot of backcountry violence with absolutely no justice for Native people because, as I said, they had no citizenship rights to appeal the theft of their land or murder and so forth. So it's a combination of state power and settler colonial violence that's destabilizing the frontier. And eventually the government expands into the American West, where this process continues, establishing forts, military garrisons, theoretically to protect Native American treaty rights and their reservations, but they were really protecting settler expansion, especially after the gold rush led to 5 million people crossing the Mississippi River. So the demographic pressure left the government either unable or uninterested in protecting Native American rights. And that, of course, led to the kind of Indian wars that we're very familiar with.
I think by that you mean like the more highly publicized wars with the Plains
yes.
Indians and the Apache,
exactly.
Crazy Horse, Sitting Bull, et cetera.
Yeah.
Let's backtrack a little bit. So there's some confusion as to what sovereignty even means. Like, I think people like to use that word. But what exactly is sovereignty and how does it apply to our situation here?
It's a great question. And that was the big question. What sovereign rights did Native people maintain after the formation of the United States? And that domestic dependent nations that the Supreme Court articulates in 1832 said that Native nations had some inherent sovereignty, but the sovereignty was embedded in the sovereignty of the United States. So eventually the U.S. Congress establishes what it called plenary power over Native nations. Congress could determine to what extent Native nations could maintain that limited sovereignty. That limited sovereignty flows from treaties that were signed between individual Native nations and the U.S. government. And in those treaties, those are both international parties. They're both nations negotiating. And those treaties were signed because the federal government didn't have the military power to extract what they wanted. So they signed these agreements that said, you have this amount of territory and you have rights to the land and the resources in that territory. And as long as those treaties were on the books, that meant that Native nations had some degree of sovereignty over that particular territory. The history of U.S. and Native American relations is really the attempt by the federal government to erode that limited sovereignty and eliminate the reservation system that was protected by those hundreds of treaties.
Yes, but what does sovereignty entail? Like, what kinds of powers or responsibilities are typically attributed to this concept?
So a treaty established a reservation, boundaries, and within that reservation boundary, Native people could form their own governments. Of course, what we have is a very coercive Bureau of Indian Affairs that integrated itself into the daily lives of Native people, told them what they could do, told them what they couldn't do, told them what they could wear, where they could go. So even within the reservation itself, the sovereign space of a Native nation, the federal government tried to manage that process. Eventually, over the course of decades into the 1970s, because of the resistance of Native people to protect that limited sovereignty, eventually they were granted through Congress the right to pass tax on companies doing business on the reservation. They could determine their own citizenship. So sovereignty is an exercise of power on Native American terms within that fixed space of the reservation. And those reservations, by the way, were whittled down over decades by new treaties. Once gold was found, for example, on the Sioux Reservation in the Dakotas, that new treaty shrunk the Sioux reservations by millions of acres. And that happened to a lot of Native nations. The book really chronicles their resilience to this settler colonialism, to state power, to the continuing effort to get rid of what a lot of white policymakers called the Indian problem. The Indian problem was that Indians wanted to remain Indians. And to do that, they needed to remain on their reservations. Because those reservations protected sacred spaces, it also protected them from the endemic racism in a white society.
You're listening to our interview with history professor Paul Rosier about his book, Indigenous Citizens. We will return after a short break. If you listen regularly to Bridging the Bones, you know we are really into the learning process here. We are aware that education isn't just something that happens in the classroom, and that reading is often fun and enjoyable for its own sake. This is why we partner with businesses selling products which make reading easier and more enjoyable. Reach out to us at contact@bridgingthebones.fyi and find out more. This is Bridging the Bones, your podcast exploring the causes, context, and potential solutions to conflict. Welcome back to our interview with Dr. Paul Rosier. We continue our talk starting with an invention of U.S. law. What quantum?
One of the tools used by the U.S. government to delegitimize some of the American Indians' claims to land was the idea of blood quantum. Could you give us a brief history of blood quantum? And I find it's particularly interesting how the blood quantum concept historically has worked in ways that affect American Indians very differently from how it has affected Black people in the United States. From my reading of your book, this becomes clear in part after the Civil War, after the Emancipation Proclamation gets signed.
That is a really important question. Both historical patterns and also contemporary issues, because blood quantum continues to matter for Native nations. After the Civil War, one of the most corrosive federal programs was the allotment program, which divided those reservations into individual plots of land, usually 160 acres or 320 acres, on the so-called yeoman farmer model, part of a way to civilize, quote-unquote, civilize Native people, forcing them to become farmers. And one way that the federal government did that was to use blood quantum to determine whether a Native person was capable of becoming civilized or not. And so we know that in Black America, if you or in America, if you had one drop of Black blood, you were considered Black. In Native America, if you had one drop of white blood, you would be, you could be categorized as white, meaning that you had enough civilization in your blood to become a citizen and to be divorced legally from the tribe, from the tribal entity. And so what the federal government did was to send out what they called competency commissions, competency commissioners that went to these reservations, interviewed people sometimes for a couple of minutes, determined if they were a half, half white, half Indian, and using that as a model, determined that anybody who had a certain percentage of white blood was deemed a citizen and no longer an Indian, which meant that they didn't have rights in the tribe and that they were exposed to the kind of land fraud taxation that stripped hundreds of thousands of Native people from their land. So blood quantum became a dividing line that established the federal government's right to determine who was an Indian and who wasn't. And that would carry into debates into the 1930s during the Great Depression, and it would carry into the 21st century when blood quantum became an issue for how a Native nation could maintain itself with declining blood quantum. One of the most interesting and complex parts of this story is that every Indian nation had a different conception of blood quantum to determine tribal membership. For example, the Cherokee, if you had 1/2000th Cherokee blood, you were still a Cherokee. Other tribal nations, you would have to be at least 1/4 or 1/2. And so every tribe had to decide to what extent will blood quantum determine our tribal citizenship. And the federal government tried to use blood quantum as a way to essentially exterminate the sociological political entity of the Indian. And they would use those words, you know, exterminate, eliminate the Indian, and that would get rid of the federal government's obligation to Native people. So blood quantum is both very complex, but very central to the story of how Native people have tried to maintain their identity in the face of this quantitative exclusion.
As we speak, there's currently a debate within U.S. society about the constitutionally written down right of birthright citizenship. But it seems like birthright citizenship wasn't, even though that became part of the Constitution after the Civil War, that didn't really apply to a lot of American Indians anyway. So why was that?
Because the They were not born under the jurisdiction of the United States. They were born under the jurisdiction of their tribal entity. So they were not deemed citizens because they were seen as beholden to a foreign power, essentially an Indian government. They were loyal to the Indian government and not the United States government. And it wasn't, of course, until the 1924 Indian Citizenship Act that all Native people were declared citizens, whether they wanted it or not. And frankly, a lot of them didn't because of that trail of broken treaties and promises. So there were efforts by Native people who wanted to assimilate, who wanted to have citizenship. There's the famous case in 1884, Elk v. Wilkins. John Elk was an Omaha Native who served in the militia. I think he owned a house. He paid taxes. He tried to register to vote, but the registrar, Wilkins, said, no, you can't vote because you're not a citizen. And the Supreme Court said, no, John Elk was born under tribal jurisdiction and not the United States. So that's where the dividing line was. And it was through this allotment program that started 3 years after the Elk v. Wilkins case. The allotment program was really the way for the government to force citizenship on Native people. So they essentially worked around that idea of birthright citizenship.
Okay. And I think the Allotment Act was also known as the Dawes Act, correct?
That's right. Yes. Henry Dawes.
1887. Now, wrapped up in the Dawes Act is the eventual statehood of the state of Oklahoma. And interestingly enough, involved in both of those situations was a man named Charles Curtis, who eventually became vice president of the United States. However, Charles Curtis was self-admittedly American Indian, to some degree.
He was proud of his heritage.
Yeah, I believe he's noted as being Kaw, Osage, and Potawatomi, as well as French, Scot, and Welsh, which were like white categories. So could you tell us a little bit about that story? Because there seems to be like a very interesting paradox and tension within that political alignment.
Right. So he was the first person of color to gain into the executive branch as vice president. But he was also resented, and he was a big promoter of the 1924 Indian Citizenship Act.
And that 1924 Indian Citizenship Act.
That's where all Native people became citizens. And really, by 1924, nearly two-thirds of the indigenous population were citizens, mostly through the allotment program and the competency commissions. So Curtis was also responsible for being a co-signer of the Curtis Act of 1898, I believe, which pushed Native communities in Oklahoma to accept the allotment program. So the concept of indigenous sovereignty in Indian territory, which is where the Cherokee and the Choctaw and dozens of other nations were forced to move to, that eroded that tribal sovereignty. So the Curtis Act was one of these wedges into tribal sovereignty to force them to adopt elements of the so-called American way, the white American way. And one of the things that most people don't know about is that the Cherokee and the Choctaw Native nations in Oklahoma had some of the most advanced social programs, welfare programs, educational programs. They had schools and academies and so forth. And the federal government broke up those institutions, ironically, during the Great Depression of 1893 and 1897. And one of the arguments that Native people made was, you're forcing a system on us that has produced great poverty in your country. And here in this country, we don't know poverty. We take care of each other. But there was this insistence on Native people acting like Americans in every way. So Curtis is an example of a mixed race politician who managed to make his way in white America, who also took some pride in his native heritage. But that was one particular view of what a Native American could be. And that was within white society. Thorpe is another example of an acculturated, mixed race Native person.
I'm sorry, you said James Thorpe?
Jim Thorpe.
Who was Thorpe.
The,
okay.
The famous Olympic athlete, first president of the National Football League.
Okay.
Yeah, so they were Native. They were Native people who didn't want to go back to this tribal identity. They were willing to embrace American society. They had achieved some success politically or economically, and so you have this emerging schism in Native America between assimilated people who were willing to embrace American society and those who wanted no part of it. Part of this is based on class, you know, educated people, professional Native people had much better success in white society than people living in reservations and rural parts of the country. So you could be a mixed race Native person who still believed in the value of an Indian identity, a tribal association, and function in American society. And that's what the 1924 Citizenship Act promised. It promised U.S. citizenship, but it also protected tribal citizenship. So what you have is dual citizenship that becomes the basis for Native people's survival in the 20th and 21st century.
Okay. So Charles Curtis both supported the Indian Citizenship Act, and he also supported, I believe he also co-wrote, to some degree, the Allotment Act.
Well, he supported the Curtis Act, which was an extension of the Allotment Act in Oklahoma Territory.
Okay. Because he felt that Indians generally would benefit from becoming citizens,
farmers,
at least in theory, on par with white citizens.
Yes, on paper, right. But they were still, quote unquote, Indians, and they were viewed as such, still viewed as savage, still viewed as uncivilized. You know, into the 1950s, you have racist signs saying no dogs or Indians allowed. I mean, it's basically Jim Crow throughout most of Indian America. So Curtis was able to insulate himself from that. He believed that the best path forward for Native people was to adopt elements of the Great White Way.
That's interesting, in part because it demonstrates that racial diversity and representation in avenues of power, of official government, state power, for instance, sometimes doesn't actually work for the benefit of the people that they are supposedly representing.
The irony is that Charles Curtis would not have been able to vote in Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, Utah, because those states had passed voter exclusion legislation precisely to prevent Native people from contributing to the practice of democracy in those states. Those were states with fairly large Native populations. So Curtis, if he had been in Arizona, couldn't have voted. New Mexico couldn't have voted. So it was a very limited piece of legislation that did not deal with the endemic racism on a state level or on a local level.
It sounds like part of indigenous citizenship story, part of this, of the larger arc, if you will, of indigenous citizenship, of American Indian citizenship, Native American citizenship, what have you, that there's this internal tension within the concept of citizenship, whereby how citizenship kind of allows for certain kinds of class mobility, right, amongst mm-hmm. those American Indians who have the combination of talent, perseverance, and luck mm-hmm. to move themselves up. like Charles Curtis did. From my understanding, there's this like ongoing rhetoric, an ongoing pattern by which people who are not born in the United States or who are not deemed sufficiently white or sufficiently, you know, American, whatever that means, that there's this ongoing rhetoric and idea that you come to the United States, and when they say that, they usually say, come to America, right? Mm-hmm. You come to America, you forget who you were in the past, you become American, and you become a good, working, productive citizen in the model of America, and you can potentially, you or your children can reach, you know, astronomical heights. When people say that, they point to, you know, movie stars like Sidney Poitier, or they, I'm sure in the early 1900s, people were pointing to Charles Curtis. And they're saying, look at how this American Indian made good on citizenship.
The American dream.
I'm sorry?
It's the American dream. Anyone can do anything if they pull themselves up by their bootstraps.
Right, right. There does seem to be an inherent tension between the American dream, as is popularly known. And of course, when we say American dream, we're talking about a very U.S.-centric discussion of what American means. So there's this inherent tension between the American dream and this idea of loyalty to one's tribe, of loyalty to one's heritage, to one's ancestry.
During World War I, German Americans were seen as loyal to the German state, Italian Americans. And this is one of the things that Native people said is, you know, a Jewish American, an Italian American, they have a relationship with that heritage. It doesn't make them less patriotic. And in fact, one of the themes of the book is American Indians' promotion of their patriotism in wartime, to say we're willing to defend the concept of the United States, but our definition of the United States is one that values cultural diversity, and that that cultural diversity is a strength, not the melting pot version that most people trotted out. That you can be, you can celebrate your heritage and still believe in the America of immigrants. And so people just didn't want to give that dual citizenship idea to Native Americans, precisely because they continued to control millions of valuable acres during times when the country was still expanding, especially after World War II. The demand for oil, gas, and timber was incredible. They didn't want Native people to maintain control of their ancestral homelands. They thought it was un-American. They called them communists. They called them socialists. They use all kinds of rhetorical devices to show that American Indians weren't patriotic, when in fact they were some of the most patriotic Americans because they had the most at stake in fighting for this version of America that really goes back to the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. They use those founding documents all the time to say, hey, we're fighting in the name of this kind of an America that is at the heart of the founding of the country.
After a brief respite from previous attempts to further shrink reservations, this to be covered in a future bonus episode, the federal government tried again, indirectly, through the Voluntary Relocation Program, started by President Harry Truman and continued by Eisenhower.
This was post-World War II, where during the Cold War, you have the federal government really imposing a limited definition of who an American was. And Native people, by virtue of their communal practices, were targeted as socialists and communists. And the relocation program was specifically designed to take Native people off the reservation, put them in cities as a way to weaken the integrity of reservation governments and economies. They hoped that if they could get Indians off the reservation, there would be no more Indians, no more Indian problem. That's the precise kind of discourse. So the relocation program became the most heavily funded federal program dealing with Native people, instead of economic development on the reservations, which is what Native people called for. They said, why are you giving tens of billions of dollars to former enemies, the Germans and the Italians and so forth, and not giving us any support on our own reservations? They said, you're helping other nations, but not us. So
they were invoking, to contextualize this, you're talking about the Marshall Project, right?
Marshall Plan of Marshall Plan. European economies, but also the Point 4 program, which was designed to support developing nations and create allies in the Cold War. So the government in the Point 4 program gave billions of dollars to so-called third world countries as a way to get them to be loyal to the United States. And interestingly, the Native people said, we're the original developing nation in this country, and you're ignoring us while giving billions to other countries. So the Cold War was an interesting period for Native people to articulate their version of American loyalty.
And part of what emerged from the Cold War and from the so-called voluntary relocation programs was also a new form of urban Indian identity, correct?
Yes, pan-tribal. A lot of relocatees came from multiple different communities, and they would gather in Indian, so-called Indian centers, where they would learn about different customs. They would also learn about the racism and discrimination that they faced in the city, and they became aware of how the Indian continued to be treated poorly, and it fostered a real sense of community organizing that eventually manifested in really influential groups like the National Indian Youth Council, eventually the American Indian Movement. So they both celebrated Indian heritage in the cities, but also provided a network to help people navigate the police brutality and the housing and job discrimination that most of these relocatees experienced. In fact, most of them, or I'd say a good number of them, returned to their reservations because conditions were so bleak in American cities in the 1950s. But for the young generation that survived into the 1960s, became a real politicizing force to create these pan-tribal associations.
I think it's notable that in our current times, a lot of people think of American Indians or Native Americans as one group, mm-hmm. right? Like whereas what you're saying is that before the urbanization of natives, of American Indians, that it didn't sound like that was the case, that these were very separated, sometimes by their own traditions, mm-hmm. separated nationalities or separate mm-hmm. or separated tribes. Mm-hmm.
To some extent, but the boarding schools was another place where pan-tribal identity formed, learning different languages, learning common experiences. And then in the 1950s and 1960s, you have young Native people going to workshops, learning about decolonization, for example, learning about how countries around the world were trying to get rid of their colonial shackles. And so a lot of Native people started to identify with these decolonizing nations around the world and to think of themselves as victims of ongoing colonialism. So I think the pattern of pan-tribal identity and organization really goes back to the boarding schools, in part because Native people were migrating to cities during World War I for jobs, World War II for jobs. So it's part of a longer arc. But the relocation program was such an aggressive program that it did swell the number of Native people in the cities. And that's what the boarding school system did. The boarding school has a very mixed legacy. It produced tremendous trauma for Native people. The boarding schools were swelled by refugees of the allotment program, which took away most of the valuable land that Native people had. And the boarding schools became a place for indoctrination, for forced citizenship education. And eventually the boarding schools become essentially employment agencies for white businesses, especially in the American West. So Native girls were trained to be domestic servants. Native boys were trained to be mechanics and so forth. But one of the things the boarding school did was produce a generation of very well-educated Native activists, intellectuals, who became really the vanguard for Native resistance to achieve citizenship and to maintain Indian identity.
The Indian vote, so to speak, started gaining power, you note, a few decades after the turn of the 20th century. It seems to be both, I think, energized, but also limited.
Vote?
In terms of the ability of American Indians to vote in blocks, to influence policy or to influence who gets into government.
Right. Yeah, well, that's because of those voter suppression tactics that state legislatures, mostly Republican states, started in 1924 after the Indian Citizenship Act. They became even more toxic in the 2010s and 2020s because Native people, in part because of gaming revenues, allowed them to be more assertive in national politics. But in really key Senate races, especially in Montana, North Dakota, and South Dakota, the voting blocks that you referenced were very much in favor of Democratic candidates because it was the Republicans like Eisenhower, like Reagan, who were really seeking to delegitimize and weaken tribal governments. And that's been one of the great stories of American Indian civil rights, the insistence that citizenship guaranteed them the right to participate in democratic practices. And that really bore fruit in those key elections, 2010s. It was critical in 2020 when the majority of Native voters supported Biden over Trump because of the way Trump treated them in the 2010s. So that has led to a different kind of backlash, a legislative backlash, which continues today. I mean, you're going to find states like Montana, Arizona, North Dakota, South Dakota, some of the largest population of indigenous people. The legislature always looks for ways to make it harder for them to vote, to eliminate mail-in ballots, and polling places on reservations are really few and far between. So it's a very conscious strategy to limit their citizenship rights.
We need to talk about the Republican representation of American Indians, because currently the highest ranked American Indian in government is Mark Wayne Mullen, Cherokee. Mm-hmm. I think he recently got sworn in as Department of Homeland Security Secretary, replacing, yes, I think, Kristi Noem. So how do these prominent Republican American Indians, who, by the way, for some reason, seem to accumulate around the state of Oklahoma or thereabouts, how does that speak to this partisan tension, like within different perspectives of what it means to be an American Indian and what it means to be simultaneously a U.S. citizen?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I'm not sure I'll provide. So one of the dividing factors is the states in which you have the largest indigenous populations. Arizona, I come back to, Dakotas, Montana. Those, especially Republicans, and I don't want to paint this as just Republicans, but for the most part, it's been Republican politicians who have been opposed to Native sovereignty, to dual citizenship, to reservations, and so forth. But one of their complaints was that because Native people lived on reservations, they didn't pay their fair share of taxes. And therefore, the states shouldn't give them their fair share of benefits, which was which was an argument without merit because Native people paid excise taxes, state taxes, federal taxes, gasoline taxes, all of those kind of day-to-day things. What they didn't pay was a property tax because their reservations were held in trust by the federal government. So there's been this resentment against what a number of Republican politicians have called super citizenship rights, that Native peoples have rights that other Americans don't, and therefore that's un-American. And they do have rights that are embedded in treaties. That is what defines the relationship between Native Americans, the federal government, and the states. And in fact, courts have ruled that tribal governments have similar rights as state governments because they control territory and they control what happens within that territory. But state governments don't like that. They don't like the idea of a government within the government. And so their effort to limit voting rights has been one of the hallmarks of their campaigns.
Since the topic of your book is dual citizenship, I would like to note that currently there's over 24 countries that recognize dual citizenship, including the United Kingdom, Sweden, New Zealand, Germany, Israel, Greece, Spain, and Chile.
Okay.
Given my limited understanding, the situation of Native Americans/American Indians is special because it's precisely a nation within a nation. And in some ways, it seems to repudiate this understanding that I think developed in the, 1600s or something, that a nation constitutes one people and one culture. Would you call that a development of the idea of nationalism, or is it just a temporary, pit stop?
That is a big, big question. But if you think about the formation of European nations in the 19th century, France, for example, the France experience, and I think to some extent it's relatable to the U.S., but the idea that the French had to create a national identity with all of these regional dialects, all of these regions that, wanted to maintain home rule and wanted to maintain their version of what French was. They didn't even speak French. And so you have a lot of assimilation going on in the late 19th century into the 20th century that eventually will create tensions between who is a Frenchman, who is an Englishman, who is an American. And it's that effort to define who can be an American, that Native peoples, they waded into that discussion and asserted their view, which is America is a place of cultural diversity, and that's a strength, because it shows the rest of the world, especially during the Cold War and decolonization, that the U.S. respects different identities, different people, and different practices. And that's the strength of this country. Today, in 2026, we're dealing with an America that has a very limited view of who an American is and who could be an American. You have immigration rules that are eliminating people from entering the country. They're kicking people out. So these things are, they're really hard to pin down as a universal experience or as a fixed position, because right now we're dealing with a different kind of nationalism, a racial, ethnic nationalism that makes it very difficult for some people to be considered a part of the American state.
On that note, thank you very much, Dr. Rosier. It has been a pleasure to talk about the admittedly extremely diverse and sometimes contradictory history of Indigenous citizenship.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
You've just heard our conversation with Dr. Paul Rosier, about his research for his book, Indigenous Citizens, Native Americans Fight for Sovereignty, 1776 to 2025, published by W.W. Norton and Company.
Bridging the Bones is an independent podcast free of influence from Fortune 500 companies, governments, or political parties. You can access bonus material and timestamps for each episode on our website, bridgingthebones.fyi. And you can find most episodes on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
Thank you to Anton Vlasov for this week's music track, Binary. I am Settling Wang. Until next time.